Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
And welcome to The First Time with me, Matt Everett. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential figures in music and take a look at the pivotal first moments that made them who they are today. From Blur, it's Graham Coxon. Even as far back as their first album, Leisure, in 1991, Graham's guitar playing always put Blur ahead of their peers. In between the Manchester baggy beats, you can hear a musician who's trying to mangle the Smiths, the Jesus and Mary Chain, and the Jam all together to produce his own sound. From there, he helped guide Blur to become one of the UK's biggest bands, mastering pop on Parklife, then giving them a new lease of life by absorbing the US underground rock scene in the late 90s. Here, Graham talks about his childhood and early days with Blur, as well as his painful split from the band in the wake of his battles with alcohol in 2002, as well as his reunion with the band and their triumphant comeback. He also talks about his own successful solo career, 8 albums so far, that span everything from pastoral folk to fuzzed-up electronica, and from lo-fi acoustic records to garage rock, just like that track you just heard from 2006, Standing On My Own Again. He's respected and admired by his peers. Musicians like Paul Weller, Noel Gallagher, Johnny Marr and Johnny Greenwood are all fans, and his work, both solo and with Blur, document his development from a noise-obsessed upstart into a uniquely musical voice and a genuine British guitar hero. And I started by asking Graham, as I do with all my guests on the show, when was the first time he was aware of music?
It would have been my dad playing stuff. It may have been during some sort of Easter egg hunt thing. He'd like to put Beethoven's Ninth on during that. Which, of course, you know, Ode to Joy, which gets more and more intense and loud and dramatic and scary, really, for a 5-year-old. Whilst looking for Easter eggs and your sister finding hers quicker than you. And the Beatles would have been absolutely staple.
Were you from quite a musical household?
It was. Well, my dad's a clarinet player, can play sax player, tin whistle. And I was very quickly pretty adept at using the record player, getting the old singles out and things like that before I could really read what they were. I was sticking records on. So,
which Beatles tracks were the ones that you used to really love?
Well, there was this thing that I'd look for the white side, the Apple records, and there was the green side, the outside of the Apple, and the B side was as if the Apple had been cut in half, the white bit inside. And I would always look for Revolution, the B side of Hey Jude, but I couldn't read, so I couldn't tell why. Sometimes I got Turn, Turn, Turn by Mary Hopkin.
To everything.
And if I was lucky, I got Revolution by the Beatles. I couldn't work out why the same record had two different songs depending on the day.
Say you want a revolution, well, you know. We all want to change the world.
So it's pretty confusing. And also pretty good with the albums because, you know, on some of them, if you turned one of the knobs, which I didn't know was balance, to the left, you could cut the voices out and just hear sort of drums and guitars, or turn it the other way and just hear the vocal.
Or the heavy panning on those Beatles tracks.
Yeah,
amazing.
It's just the sort of early stereo where they have the, you know, all the voices in one side and instruments in the other side. And I didn't understand why that didn't happen all the time. So it was pretty magic stuff.
What about the first record that was yours, that you owned, that you saved up for or got given? That was that belonged to you rather than someone else's, that you chose?
I think I got Roxanne by the Police on 45. I don't know when that would have been. 79?
78, 79, yeah.
78. And I think I got that purely because of the backing vocals in the chorus.
It's a pop song.
Yes, yeah, it's a good sounding little song. It's got a good chord progression, chorus, lots of good backing harmony things going on. You know, not posh, to the point. So I think I like that. And I think anything that had backing vocals in reminded me of the Beatles, and so I'd buy it.
Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Those days are over. You don't have to sell your body to the night. Roxanne, you don't have to wear that dress tonight. Walk the streets for money. Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Roxanne, you don't have to put on the red light. Roxanne, 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 Roxanne.
What about your first guitar hero? Was it Pete Townshend? Was that the first kind of person you remember thinking, he's got that instrument, I like what he's doing with that shape of wood he's got?
Yeah, definitely Pete Townshend, I should imagine. I think I was obsessed with The Kid's All Right, that film, just made up of loads of live bits and interviews, TV appearances and all the rest of it, and instantly dreamed of Rickenbackers and things. And I guess this was, you know, just pre-teenage, 10, 11. I started playing the guitar when I was 13 and still dreamt about Rickenbackers, Telecasters, and all the rest of it, would do drawings of them. And
on the school books?
Yeah, on the school books. Draw the Jam logo on my school books, the Who, Kinks, all those sort of usual things. I mean, it was no secret to my school chums and whatever that I was into that sort of stuff, because I'd be in school in a parka and desert boots and all that.
And spot mod.
Yeah, a bit of a mod, one of the few mods at school. You know, Listen to You Really Got Me by the Kinks. I didn't really want my mum and dad to know that I was a sort of a mod, so I kept it. You know, I thought they'd think I'd be fighting a lot or being a hooligan and
going down to Brighton,
things like that. Yeah, so I sort of did. I used to listen to You Really Got Me by the Kinks really quietly or furtively. It was my sort of little pleasure.
Girl, you really got me going. You got me so I don't know what I'm doing.
your side. Girl, you really got me now. You got me so I can't sleep at night.
Once again, still an incredible sounding record sonically. Mm. It's a remarkable recording, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, I think that these sort of recordings have just stuck with me. You know, it's impossible to get bored during that. It's impossible to get bored during Any Way, Anyhow, Anywhere by The Who or My Generation. And so I think whilst I was listening to all that stuff growing up, my threshold for boredom is pretty low. Is it or is it high? No, it's low. I get
low,
bored
yeah.
very easily.
Right.
I need pretty much a constant entertaining if I'm listening to, say, in the old school way, sort of a single, you know. It needs to be exciting. That's why it was so hideous when Turn, Turn, Turn would come on instead of Revolution. You know, the difference is quite stupendous.
Did you go to many gigs when you were at that age? You got a chance to go to many gigs?
No, I didn't.
Your first gig?
My first one was the Osmonds. And that makes me seem a lot older than I am. But I was about four. And it was in the Berlin Emporio Bigger Max, whatever, you know, whatever they had there. And I really just remember small people and a lot of lights. I don't really remember anything else, but I got a plastic Osmond's hat. And there's a photo of me. I think my parents have got a photo of me. When I came back from that, with my Osmond's hat on, my plastic trumpet, and in my pyjama bottoms. And that's quite a good picture. But after that, no, I didn't. I lived in Colchester, you know, the outskirts of Colchester. I used to go out to discos, of course, and things like that. And I used to like listening to loud music, go to the townhouse in Colchester on Tuesday nights, and it would be a sort of a mod night. But gigs didn't happen till a lot later. I saw the Style Council at the Ipswich Gaumont when I was maybe 14. Supported by Billy Bragg and The Questions. And so that was a big treat. And I remember it being really loud. And I was right at the back in one of the little boxes they have at the Gaumont there. So that was really good, seeing the Style Council. Never saw the Jam.
Streets that mean nothing to you. You believe you're above it, and I don't really blame you. Maybe that's why you speak like a child. The things you're saying, like I'm so free and so wild. And I believe it when you look in my eyes. You offer me life and never lies. It's not in the kind to make me smile. So come and your mind is productive. Where
Then the Smiths was my next gig, and that was travelled all the way to Brixton from Colchester to see that.
Did you have Marr worship? Had you focused in on that point as seeing him as a hero, which he clearly is a guitar?
Okay. I hadn't really. It was odd. I found his playing absolutely beautiful, and I'd sit and try and work it out. I liked all of them. I really liked them as a group. Obviously, Pete Townshend for me and Keith Moon stuck out as heroes. Pretty terrible role models in one way, as I found out later. You know, amazing energy. And I think Marr was a very laid-back and suave guitar player, and his parts were intricate and really lovely. But I think, you know, it was a Morrissey Marr thing, yeah. Incredible, really great bass player, really overlooked, I think. But the Smiths' bass lines are superb.
What Smiths track should we play?
Could we have William, It Was Really Nothing? Of course, just for the hell of it.
The rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down. Oh, the rain falls hard on a humdrum town. This town has dragged you down.
Another first we have to talk about is the first time you met Damon. Was it something about shoes? Is this right?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, this was around the time when it was a mod revival, two-tone thing. It was just at the tail end of that, I suppose, 11, 12. And the Leather Soul Brogues, that were pretty much all the rage, and a lot of kids had these, and white socks, and sort of they were drain pipe eyes there. School uniform trousers. Used to wear these trousers called Ziggies, which were quite narrow. I've never been able to find them since, but they were really great trousers. I had these shoes, they were rather good actually now, I mean, by Tuff, T-U-F, and they were workman's shoes. They were sort of oil resistant and all the rest of it. And sort of Damon came over and he had this lovely black trench coat as well, and his hair was all blonde and fluffy at the front, and, you know, dishy bloke, and got more shoes are better than yours. You know, I look at mine are proper, or something like that, and sort of looked at himself in the reflective surface nearby and flounced off. And I'd seen him a few days before in a school assembly doing the, from a West Side Story, the Officer Krupke song. Gee, Officer Krupke, Krup you. And he was doing that. I got a social disease.
Hey, I got a social disease. So take him to a social worker.
Which way?
That, you know, that lead part, and I couldn't believe the audacity, the sort of confidence, yeah. I've never met anyone so confident, it freaked me out totally. But not long after that, you know, I started playing the sax, and he needed a sax player on a song he was writing, which was a pretty little sort of song, love song. And so we went to our mate Mike Morris's home studio and recorded it.
What were those first Blur gigs like? Because they seemed to be, from the footage that you see, like barely contained, on the edge of sort of falling apart all the time, and all the more exciting for it, but definitely chaotic.
They were. I mean, we weren't very good at what we were doing. You know, I've been playing since 13, and I've been playing 5 years or something. So not that long. I hadn't really developed any kind of style apart from a style I have developed. Seems to be make a load of noise to cover up your technical inadequacy. Basically, that was it. It was sort of play the chords in a sort of a nice way and do some little flashy bits if you could manage in the verses, and then in the choruses turn the distortion pedal off and just play the chords as loud as possible. And that was sort of what I do. But Damon was mad, and I've seen footage recently of sort of 1989 Harlow Square or something. Damon was pretty crazy. We would often jump on top of Alex and send him flying, get on his shoulders, and then sort of like a sort of bendy drunk giraffe come over to my side of the stage, wipe out my pedals, unplug everything, and then be sit by behind my amp. That was pretty much what happened regularly at our shows. They would last about a quarter of an hour before they sort of destructed and collapsed. Pretty weird. I mean, I hated it because I wanted to get to the end of the set. I enjoy it, but Damon was intent on destroying. Very, very driven, very overexcited. Just couldn't help but lose it. You know, very involved in his world on stage. We had a weird group of fans from art schools and things like that who would follow us around and do their weird dancing. And that was it. I don't know why anybody saw any kind of saw anything in it. You know, Andy Ross eventually started to come and see us quite regularly, and we were sort of puzzled. I was puzzled. I mean, I thought we were good. I thought we had some good songs and everything, but our presentation was dreadful. We were trying to be arty. We were half art school, half sort of squat punk looking kind of people with beads and rubbishy tank tops and old jeans and desert boots, you know. So we weren't hardly sort of glamorous. And there was a lot of sick, a lot of red wine and noise and pretty much amateurish playing.
First single, 1990, which is She's So High, and I know. She's So High has that's kind of endured really well. It's still a staple of the set. There's a couple of tracks off that first album, Leisure, kind of still regarded as being far better than maybe people thought they were at the time. Is that a fair thing to say?
Maybe, yeah. She's So High is always good. I mean, that doesn't mean much. You know, the story behind it is hardly a story, I suppose. It's kind of about being besotted by somebody. Mildly sort of psychedelic. I think the effort that went into the recording, you know, it was our first go at doing any recording. And
did it go all right? Did you know what you were doing?
Not really. You know, it was Steve Power and Steve Lovell together producing that song, and I had to learn it all backwards because there's a lot of backwards guitar on it.
Oh.
So I learned it back to front. It's always been one of those ones that's, I guess, not too much stress to play. Pretty simple. Has the desired effect.
I'm not going to dwell on Britpop too much, but when Park Life first came out, there's this thing, when I speak to other musicians who have, like, that big hit album, they kind of say it's like being coated in gold for a while. Everything you do just goes right. You can't put a foot wrong. You could step out in front of traffic and cars would bounce off you because it's going so well. It was an incredible success. Did you feel a bit invincible at the time?
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of parties, a lot of and there were award ceremonies, etc. And this thing suddenly took off, massive Reading sort of success festival thing. But I don't know. I just always felt very scared because it is Yeah, I suppose I felt like I could walk out into traffic and not get hit by a car, or cars would bounce off me, and I probably tried it quite a lot during that time. Actually, yeah, I did. I did actually get hit by a car.
Actually get hit by a car, yeah.
Yeah, I did, so it doesn't work.
But yeah. You know, I mean, that thing where, you know, you are the golden voice of the media, and everyone loves everything you do and say, and you get away with...
It's stressy, yeah. Because suddenly that noise that people make when you go on stage, suddenly there's a lot of younger people. And you know what that noise is like. That sort of screaming sound is really a little bit off-putting. You know, it's a pretty scary sound.
I remember you at Mile End, you were wearing an army helmet and full army fatigues. It was like, do you feel like you're a bit shell-shocked? Was that a reflection of your state of mind?
Yeah, it was. I mean, you sort of strive to be signed and to get on top of the pops, really, or something, to get your... And you listen to your single being played on the radio, and I'm still doing that, like, today, you know. My new single's on the radio, excellent. But then you're there, you know, you've got to strap yourself in and sort of... You don't know what's going to happen. You know, you've got to where you wanted to get, and you're on this train, and you don't know where it's going to go, necessarily, you know. And people are having a good time for you, but I found within the mid-90s that there were more people wanting to hate you because you were doing well.
We love you. Like, no, we changed our minds now. We don't like you anymore.
Yeah. It was an odd time. There's a lot of resentfulness around within groups and in the industry and everything. I found it a little bit of a pain, really. I thought it's not a very nice world. This is a lie, but it won't hurt you when you're alive. It will be there when you find it ways to stay. Time for pain, comedy. There's a low in the high 40s. Saturdays locked away on the pier. Not fast enough, dear.
That was This Is A Low by Blur, and you're listening to the first time here on Six Music with me, Matt Everett, and that was a track from Blur's 1994 album Park Life, and features the sublime guitar playing of my guest this week, Graham Coxon.
Six Music.
Six.
Tender is the night, lying by your side. Tender is the touch of someone that you love too much. Tender is the day, the demons go away.
Welcome back to The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest this week, one of the country's greatest guitarists, Graham Coxon. And that was from Blur's 1997 album, The Beautiful Tender. The accepted sort of wisdom is that Blur's kind of reinvention in the wake of the huge success of Quiet Life and The Great Escape was to embrace alternative American music. And Pavement was the band that was mentioned frequently at the time. When did you first fall in love with Malkmus and the world of American indie rock and Pavement?
I'd annoy the rest of the group and tour buses by playing all this old... Really, what American groups were doing at this time... There were some guitar players in Britain I thought that were quite exciting, but really it did revolve around playing chords and strumming. And you know, I'd had that all of my life. I could play sort of a bit like a Kinks record. I could play a bit like a bit of a Beatles record. I was a bit sick of it. And really the American groups like Sonic Youth, Pavement, and some of the smaller punk groups, Slint and all of this lot, they were doing some really interesting stuff rhythmically, sonically with guitars and with drums. It was almost like a kind of indie guitar rock jazz kind of thing that I sort of... I mean, I used to love watching Steve Malkmus play. You know, he had this very mature attitude where he almost had a jazz thing about it, where he'd stand there and his head would wobble about and, you know, he'd suavely kind of play these beautiful little lines, you know, solo.
Can you treat it like an oil well? Can you it's underground, out of sight. And if the sight is just a horse sign, can it make enough sense to me? Pretend the table is a trust knot. We'll put our labels down, pages down. I'll watch them yarn and twine unravel, and you'll never get it back. What I want, it's what I want. Twine comes down. It's what I want, it's what I want. Don't you know I could make it try, make it try, make it try, make it try. I've been crowned the king of it, and it is all we have, so wait.
There was a sort of freedom. They'd allow themselves freedom to just be a little bit expressive here, and I thought that the Britpop thing and Blur were really getting bogged down by structure. That was how we'd learnt, and then it took us a long time to get out of that, and I think that album Blur, that's when we sort of did it.
Tell me about The Sky's Too High. It's 1998, your first solo effort. Lo-fi is definitely the word. Billy Childish was someone that you talked about a lot, I think, when you released that record. Was he a direct influence on it?
Well, he was a kind of an influence. I suppose what had happened, I'd written a song called You're So Great, which was my first little attempt at a sort of a song or a ditty or some sort of expression of... It was a very innocent little song, and it was very nerve-wracking to record. Yeah, you know, singing lead vocal and everything like that.
Even having been in front of these massive screaming audiences, it was still difficult to...
Oh, that's different. That's different. I mean, sort of trying to sing along a lead vocal when you can hear me as clear as you can right now to a producer who's... It was just my problem. Just very nervous and very shy. But a neighbour of mine had written the script for a film and said he wanted me to write a couple of songs. I said, well, I don't write songs. I'm just a guitar player in this group. I don't write songs. And he went, oh, come on, you can do it. You can write songs. You're in a band and all that. He didn't really know much about what my sort of situation was. I thought, well, all right, I'll give it a go. And I wrote a couple of songs, Me, You, We, Two, and A Day Is Far Too Long. And I thought, this is quite nice. I got a sort of a fulfilment out of, even if it was just very simple... crappy adolescent poetry and very simple guitars. I sort of thought, this is a bit like a Baroque diary. It's sort of quite a nice thing to do, actually. You know, it felt quite good. You could sort of hide behind it. You didn't have to be too overtly detailed. You could be vague, you know. It's all right, this songwriting. And I sort of did some more, and it ended up being that. I remember Sky's Too High, yeah. The song on that called Are You Lonely? And I thought, that was really, really nice. And then one that I still play, the I Wish. I wrote it in the grand old Opry Hotel.
And with a cowboy hat on.
It doesn't sound very country and western orientated, but there was a massive country and western award ceremony as well going on. It was raining, and I wrote that. That's why there's a lot of mention of rain.
I wish this rainy day could be the last. Could the world end? What a godsend. I wish I could stop wishing you were here, but I don't want to, 'cause I'd still want you. So flipping mad. Don't wanna scare you. Just wanna love you.
your vocals, Coffee and TV. That's you singing on your first actual Graham Coxon penned hit. It sounds like a song to sobriety. Is that about right?
I guess so. I think that was around some sort of time when I was thinking, God, hangovers are horrible, aren't they? And it was the first of many songs about feeling slightly rough, walking around Camden and having moments of soppiness. It's all around that, you know, marry me, I'm going to get out of this life. But really, it's from the aspect of a sort of someone who's stacking shelves, I think, really.
Do you feel like a chain store?
You mentioned the hangovers. Can you remember the point when you thought that maybe the drinking and the going out and that was getting in the way of what you did as a musician?
No, I don't think it ever got in the way of that. It got in the way a little bit of my relationships, friendships. It was odd, but then you don't know who your friendships and relationships, you're not quite sure who you're having them with. It's a very confusing world. And yeah, going out in those pubs in Camden, you could have someone who's your best mate one night, and he's your best mate because he's noticed you've got a few tenors in your wallet. And then when those tenors have gone, they've cleared off. I didn't really like the big music busy thing. You know, I found it sort of cynical and weird.
It is cynical and weird.
Yeah.
That's why you found it.
I just couldn't trust anybody or anyone said. Everyone would be smiling and saying, yeah, great, da 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 da. And I think that really hit home when we went to America a couple of times when they'd get your name wrong and you're sort of... I'd be called Brian a lot in America. Hey, what's your name? I'd be like, Graham. Like, hi, Brian. And
Brian Coxon.
Yeah, Brian. And you're like, no. And before you've even said, you know, they're off saying hello to somebody else. They don't even care. And I just thought, then no one cares. And I sort of really overreacted. I went mega morose, yeah. And just thought, well, I'll just talk to... This is the old painter and decorators. I just thought I'd talk to normal people and other kids that aren't particularly famous, just having lives. And I just found that a lot more interesting than this world where I just thought it was a lot of sort of nonsense, really.
This is a ballad for the good times. So put a battery in your leg. Broken every bone. Everybody.
Can I ask you about Think Tank, which was 2002, which was the record that you kind of did some work on, did Battery in My Leg, which is an absolutely brilliant track, and then Partly Company with the remaining members who carried on. When did you first realise they were going to carry on without you, and how did that feel?
That was odd. I'd been in rehab And gosh, I mean, it was just absolute coincidence, hideous coincidence, really. And I knew that we were coming up to start recording. And I think the whole idea of starting to record and put myself through that again, I was pretty selfish, rubbish sort of person to be with. I found touring really difficult, being away from home really difficult. So this approaching recording session was getting, it was making me feeling very anxious. It was making me sort of, you know, drink quite a lot until I just thought, crikey, I'm going a bit mental. I think I should, you know, go and see a doctor. So I went to see a doctor and ended up just getting dried out and everything else. But I couldn't really, this doctor wanted me in. And he wanted me in to talk to me and all of this, get me dried out and see what I wanted to do. But it really coincided with them starting the sessions. But there was a lot of misunderstanding about why it coincided, and I didn't do it on purpose. That was at the end of 2001, I think. And then 2002, I went in and realised that actually there was quite a lot of resentment. And, you know, absolutely fine, really, for them to be pretty resentful of me going missing for a month, even though I thought it was pretty essential that I did what I did. And we tried a few songs, and I thought we were getting on okay. You know, it was a bit odd. But my thing is that I had to really be honest. I said, look, I'm really into getting involved in this album, but I really can't commit to the promotional touring and the touring. I thought it would be really dangerous. And I've been advised by, you know, doctors and things like this that was what I should say. I should be open and honest about it and say, you know, if I'm going to go on promotional tours and tours, that's going to put myself in a lot of danger for relapsing, etc., etc. So I just wanted to be open and honest with the boys about that. And it seemed okay, but I don't know whether we were experiencing very different things at these recording sessions, but I only did a few days, and Boucher and Your Leg was one of them. We tried other songs in lots of different ways. I was finding it quite difficult to sit comfortably within them because they'd had an established situation on that album already. You know, they'd been through quite a lot already recording it. They'd been abroad and all of this and had all sorts of adventures and mishaps that I learnt about later. I think maybe I was just an element that didn't go correctly at the time. And then I met with my manager one morning and he said, you know, the band don't want you to go in anymore. And that was that. It's kind of odd. I mean, it was fairly simple. I didn't really get much of a reason. I don't know. I mean, we went over it in the documentary quite a lot. Mm. But it doesn't matter. It just didn't feel right. And that's that. You know, that's fine. And so I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I had a very small baby. I had just started out on this sober sort of existence, and I kind of thought, well, that's cool, you know, I'll just bring up my kid and get on with my life, adjust to being this sort of sober person, and just see what happens.
Well, we had the first music heard from you after that was Freaking Out and Happiness in Magazines, which are these massively, really accessible, really smashing, kind of goes back a lot to what you were talking about those early Who singles. They feel kicksing, they've got that really immediate feel about them. It's a really great record.
Nothing to see, nothing to hear, nothing to be, nothing to fear, nothing to prove, nothing to say, nothing to lose, nothing to gain, nothing to feel, nothing to hate, nothing is real.
Was that kind of part of the point, was kind of, okay, I will embrace this vivacious kind of quality?
It was weird that, because of course I had all this spare time. I didn't feel this pressure, this anxiety anymore. I was having a very chilled life. It was great. But my guitar was sitting there, and you pick it up, and suddenly these songs were sort of coming out. And I had my little four-track recorder, and I'd just go and put them down. And it was really odd, because I thought, crikey, this is pretty different from my other stuff. Mm. My other stuff was a sort of a side project, something I didn't take seriously. It was a bit, you know, making mischievous kind of little songs.
This was Graham Cox in the band.
Yeah, and this suddenly, suddenly started like, this is stuff that might do all right.
You know?
So, you know, I sort of demoed Freaking Out, demoed Bittersweet Bundle of Misery, demoed I Can't Look at Your Skin because it's doing me in, and all these other songs. And I thought, crikey, this is like, they sound like real songs that I could hear on the radio. So I sat around for a year or two. And then sort of started writing songs and started getting that thrill again of sort of writing them. But they were becoming slightly more accomplished.
The Spinning Top, let's talk about some totally different influences. David Graham was someone you talked about a lot when listening to that. Have you always had that love of the kind of English folk heritage?
Possibly not. I don't think I'd really explored it an awful lot. I'm a bit of a researcher. I sort of hit upon a sort of type of playing of this and that, and then I like to really delve into it. I just got fed up of listening to it and going, wow, these people can really play. And I just thought, well, how do they do it? Right, I'm going to work something out. So I chose this track called Jubilation by David Graham, which is a really incredibly breezy little sort of jazzy number. Like a piece of the air, it's just how you feel. Are you really there? Are you even real? I don't know which way to go. When I hear you everywhere, there's a melody in every line, and a sorrow in these eyes of mine. If a diamond hangs in every tree, and a life is lost for every leaf, can a bird still sing? I listened just this morning. This is what I heard. An angel's wings in cool night air, like a blackbird in the chapel, a starling in the moonlight, fair winds beating up a gale. In the morning, in the morning, in the morning, ooh, in the morning.
Where does this bring you now? Where are we now with your solo muse? Dance music and electric music, what people keep on saying when they've been talking about the record, but I don't know.
It's not really that, is it? Because that makes you think of Orbital and things like that.
It doesn't sound like Orbital.
It's not like that. I mean, I think it uses a bit of different sort of colours, really, different flavours to what I've used before. You know, it is guitar, it is drums, but there's a bit of drum machine here and there. I'm quite into progressive rock and stuff like that, and I was trying to sort of squash 15 minutes of progressive rock into 3 minutes or 4 minutes, you know.
Tego Mago, the single.
Yeah, it's trying to get all that excitement and all the dynamics and all that into short blasts.
How was the Blur reunion? How was the first? I mean, you've obviously spoken a load about this, and lots of people said many of the gigs that you played when you got together were better than you'd ever been. I think, you know, I saw you at Glastonbury. I would attest to that. What was it like walking on stage at Glastonbury for that first song? It must have been. There was such a lot of love. There was so much love in the field.
It was
almost unbearably emotional to watch as a punter when Damon broke down during the end of Tender and everyone in the audience was losing it. It was wonderful. It was a great thing to behold.
It's funny when men do that because, you know, you just don't know how you're going to react. And you're holding a lot in, and you've got a lot of hopes, a lot sort of invested in what you're about to do. It was really mental. That Glastonbury thing was, like I was talking about, the sound that an audience makes. I mean, that was an amazing sight. And we were absolutely cacking it before it went on. These shows made me more nervous than anything in my life. But that audience were like, when they make these huge films about medieval, you know, it's like an army, you know, with the big flags and everything, and the noise that was coming off them was sounded like 1,000 cows, you know, more than that, isn't it? And I just thought, crikey, imagine in the old days when you'd face an army like that, you know, with your sword and your shield. How scary was that? But we were about to do one of our best sort of shows ever, I suppose. An amazing job to have.
You're playing the Olympics closing celebration concert, I believe that's how you say it, is it not?
Don't ask me. I always say it wrong. I have no idea what it is. So
you represent the whole of the UK musically then, doesn't it? Looking forward to it? It's got to be a strange one to play, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. It's big, and I'll be really looking forward to it when I'm absolutely sure we can play everything we want to play.
It would be nice if, because you've kind of all talked about this a little bit, if Blur just existed and, like releasing Fool's Day, just releasing stuff as and when you feel like getting together and doing it.
I think it's good, yeah, because it's like our hobbies became our main sort of jobs. Now Blur's a Sunday band that we get together and have a cup of coffee, and, well, you know, what do you think? But things are so healthy there. Everyone seems to be really happy, and any tension that was still there, even in, you know, 2009, doing those shows, I think we've pretty much proved to each other that we're there for each other, really, as mates and as a band, and that's our place to go and muck about whenever we want to. So yeah, it's looking pretty good.
The final thing is we ask everyone to pick the final song. What should we play out on? It can be something of yours.
Should we play Jubilation by David Graham?
Let's do that. Good to speak to you. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
This is
BBC.
BBC Radio.
Six.
Music.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.
Thank you.
and I pull something new. It's the right time to give it, the right time to lose, to begin again. Maybe we